you, Philippe. I think that it is something that the key point there is that all the way through everything about medical marijuana, every medical marijuana law, largely the exception of Proposition 215, has been written in, basically for the benefit of prohibition and with the minimum necessary concessions to the patients. The patients are a threat to prohibition, you know, the foundation of most of the medical marijuana laws and the medical marijuana program in Canada. It is prohibition comes before the patients. And that is the blunt truth that people need to understand, and why I think that ultimately that Dr. Grinspoon is right, that only under full legalization will we have really proper access to medical cannabis so that the people who really need it, and particularly people in the third world, will be able to get medical access to it. A few years ago, I went over to the UK to attend a conference there, and it was sponsored in part by Release and music from Seattle. And I was very impressed to find that there was an organization called Release, which was really giving helpful advice to people with serious substance abuse problems, and that were really, in trying to give legal advice and advice on harm reduction and safe use and so on. And this was – it was something really was quite new, and I was really very impressed by it. And now Sebastian Seville is the new head of the executive director of Release. And Mr. Seville has been involved in a lot of different aspects of the substance abuse controversies and basically of how to help patients, how to help addicts and people with substance abuse problems. And, of course, throughout all of this, cannabis plays a part in terms of trying to help people with substance abuse problems. But the U.K., again, has had its own approach to things. And between Canada and the U.K. are things I think that we can learn from their mistakes and from the things that they have done right. Anyway, Sebastian Seville, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Paul and Alan and everyone here for having me. I'm very pleased to be here. I was here last year, and I very much hope to be here next year as well, if it is here. As I heard earlier, it might not be. It's been a great event, bringing the roots and tops together, which I think was a marvelous title for the conference. And I've been impressed by many, many interesting talks. One that particularly impressed me was Alison Holcomb on the opening morning, and she talked about the importance of sharing our life experiences. So before I just talk about the mundane brief I've been given about the UK and cannabis, I just thought I'd tell you how I kind of got to here a little bit. Pretty well to the day or to the week, 25 years ago, I started a 1 to 5 year prison sentence in California for a drug offense. And I was fairly tough and confident in those days, so I settled in reasonably quickly. But I'd been there about a month, and this young kid came into the prison, and he was clearly terrified. And for some reason, he sort of selected me to sort of latch onto to try and help him through the first few days. And I kind of asked him, why are you here? And this was a pretty tough prison, and he seemed very young and quite sort of naive. And he said, well, me and my friend, we were arrested on the beach with, I then understood the term as a lid of pot, which is quite a small amount, I understood. And so I said, well, how come you haven't been bailed out? He said, well, my parents thought it would be a good idea if I came to prison so I'd know what it was all about. That poor kid, I tell you, 5 days later, I was shipped off to the penitentiary, and I never know what happened to him, but I can tell you for sure that probably ruined his whole life, I can tell you. It took me 17 years to be able to come back to the United States, and I eventually got a visa to come back to actually to attend court in Los Angeles to clear up an outstanding bench warrant. And arrived at court with my lawyer, and the district attorney looked up at the judge and said, we'd like your client to finish off the other 4 years of his 1 to 5 sentence. This was only 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I looked at my lawyer and I said, is she serious? And thankfully, we had a very sort of illuminated judge up there, and he looked at the big pile of papers, these testimonials, which would allow me to even get back with a visa at all. And he looked at my lawyer and he said, are these real? Are these or are these forgeries? And my lawyer said, no, absolutely. They've been all notarized by the embassy. So he looked over to the DA and he said, what possible use would it serve to send this man back to prison 21 years after the event? And she said, well, you know, we can't send out the wrong message, you know. And he said, well, it's absolutely absurd. She said, well, at least he's got to finish his probation. And he said, well, do you suggest he commutes from London to Los Angeles to see a probation officer? And he looked over to me and he said, $1,500 fine, how would that sound, Mr. Saville, to sort this whole out? And I said, very, very fair, Your Honor. Thank you very much, sir. And just thankfully there was a very decent judge who didn't listen to the advice he was given by the court. The funny thing is, of course, although this was all cleared up 4 years ago, and I've got documentation to show it is, I've been into the States probably 12 or 15 times. I'm married to an American. I have family here in California. And I'm still on the wanted list. I came in the other 10 days ago, 3 hours at the airport, and they felt very embarrassed in there because they could clearly see that it was a mistake, but it's still there. And I've written to every federal agency, and it's just absurd. Anyway, I just thought that would just be a little insight into how I started on this road. Alan, on the opening morning, talked about effective propaganda. And I think, you know, with us at one end and the sort of un-Christian Christians at the other end, I think we're never really going to convince that end extreme of sort of change. But the chunk in the middle, I think, of, you know, with the right information and stuff, yeah, can be encouraged to change the way they think. But what I have learned is that trying to intellectually do it is not as effective as sort of using some emotive language. I was on a radio show recently with a politician, a senior police officer, on the subject of medicinal cannabis, and I thought I was going to start off by using the sort of, you know, intellectual argument, the science, this, what we've proven, the randomized control trials, et cetera, which you've heard so much about today. But I thought this is no good. And I looked over to the politician who'd been really sort of aggressive and said, so you go home tonight and your 75-year-old mom looks at you and says, you know that bone-crushing pain I've had for the last 15 years, the one that the Demerol, the morphine, the heroin, which you could even get in the UK, hasn't worked for. Well, I found something now that works, and I feel I can live again. Are you going to have her arrested? And he just fell silent, and it just kind of worked a little better than trying to explain the science. Anyway, so cannabis in the UK. I've been asked to touch on the sort of recent rescheduling controversy, so how bad is cannabis, the big hype about cannabis and mental health, so how mad is cannabis, and recent arrest figures, how sad is cannabis. First of all, whatever they tell you about cognitive impairment through smoking cannabis, it surely does not compare to thinking and speaking publicly on interferon. Halfway through my one-year course of this toxic mixture, and I could easily look from you to you and completely forget where I am, who I am, and even what I am. So forgive me for using a prepared statement. If I didn't, you could suddenly be listening to the macroeconomics of why termites like wood or something equally obscure. So I've called my talk Pot Shots from the UK, the vexed question of pot. Trying to make my brief a little interesting, I'll talk about the historical and social trajectory of cannabis in the UK leading up to the present moment, focusing on just a few of the highlights of that history, necessarily, as time is short, I've been informed, and in some of the areas of shadow thrown up by those spotlights of knowledge and power. The gaze of knowledge has been directed at this venerable plant in the course of the last century or so, during which time the British authorities have sought a way in which to deal with the vexed question of pot. And it is a venerable plant. The hemp plant has long historical association with Britain, though for much of its illustrious career, that association was indeed centered not so much on dope, but more on old rope. Indeed, upon old rope, which once rested the imperial fortunes of our land of hope and glory. Long before the spectre of pot-induced madness reared its fuddled head, or the dreadful prospect of disordered youth bestrode the great stage of politics, before our rulers furrowed their august brows over arcane questions of scientific classification, the cannabis plant was already entangled in the problem of the nation's future well-being as a primary source of rope, rope for those ships for which Britannia would come to rule the waves. While opium became the chief produce of British India and the veritable opium of the people at home, the cannabis plant led a quiet, respectful life, largely outside of the public eye, until the early decades of the 20th century. Much like here, as we heard earlier, cannabis was not included in the first UK Dangerous Drugs Act of 1920, nor in the propagations made under the Defence of the Realm Act during World War I, which prohibited the use of opium, its derivatives, and cocaine. Water, please. That's right, that's enough. Throughout the 20s, however, an increasing social and moral panic began to be generated around the use of cannabis, with Fleet Street, which is the centre of arts of journalists in the UK, reporting that this obscure Oriental drug had joined its more infamous forbidden relatives in being employed by dope by British citizens. A few notable cases aroused the interest of the press. Cannabis turned up, usually having been believed by police to be something else, in a number of provincial towns. Instantly suspicious of this hirsute foreign botanical, the police pressed unsuccessfully for the drug to be included in the 1923 amendments to the Dangerous Drugs Act. The Home Office, by contrast, initially adopted a relaxed tone in relation to these unexpected appearances, noting that the place where hashish should become confiscated possessed sizable Arab colonies, and that immigrants could only be expected to engage in these types of vices. The drug's first public appearance in London caused a real rush of press frenzy, when two North Africans were prosecuted by the police for attempting to sell a large slab of it to an undercover officer in Old Compton Street, now the very heart of fashionable Soho. The two gentlemen concerned worked in a local coffee house where they appeared in native dress, and their arrest was just too good for the tabloid newspapers to resist. "Maddening dope for the asking," screamed the Daily Chronicle. The others echoed the sentiments: hashish peril, new dope peril, and the new trade in a horrible drug. So the alarm was first sounded upon Britain's shores. In the event, the case failed for the very good reason that cannabis was not illegal, a fact which one might have expected the police to have equated before they went in. It was the pressure exercised internationally by the Egyptian government, backed with customary enthusiasm by the United States, which eventually led to the legal prohibition of cannabis in the UK. Concerned at the widespread use of the drug within the Egyptian population, there were claims that 70% of inmates in the Egyptian asylums were there as a result of its use. The Egyptian government managed, by means of diplomatic pressure, to bring cannabis within the scope of the 1912 Hague Convention. So right at the outset of UK legal regulation, the spectre of madness was invoked in relation to the use of cannabis. In order to meet its international treaty obligations, that the UK Parliament included cannabis in the 1925 Dangerous Drugs Amendments, after a debate lasting 5 minutes. It took place on the 5th of August 1925. As the bill passed through the House of Lords, Viscount Haldane rose to observe that it was impossible to form any judgment of the details of the bill, and urged that it should be taken by the House to a large extent on trust. It was. Such was the quality of the scrutiny accompanying the first legal prohibition of cannabis in Britain. The theme of linkage between cannabis and madness is nowadays particularly associated with some celebrated public information films produced by the American government. The fame Reefer Madness represents, of course, the pinnacle of achievement in this area. However, it is an older theme, a much older theme, going back to at least the 19th century, when French and British colonial adventurers in North Africa allowed their psychiatric experts the free run of the local asylums. It is a linkage. It is a linkage which has emerged once more at the forefront of cultural consciousness in the UK in recent years, and has become the object of heated controversy. In January 2004, cannabis was reclassified from a Class B to a Class C drug. The system of classification in the UK is itself under review at the present time. Embedded in the UK's 1971 Misuse of Drug Act is a system which supposedly grades drugs according to their potential to impact negatively on the health of individuals and society, and claims to be based upon scientific criteria. Whether this is the fact is highly debatable. The judgments are thoroughly implicated in the social and cultural prejudices and myths of all kinds. But that's a topic for another day. The downgrading of cannabis in 2004 was probably broadly supported by the British public, but was always controversial. A number of concerns led to the decision. Chief amongst them was the inordinate amount of police time and resources that were being directed towards arresting people for cannabis possession. It was widely recognised, in addition, that such arrests had little, if any, deterrent effect. A new consensus had formed within the Blair government that its drug policy should focus on those drugs which were perceived to cause the most harm, mainly heroin and cocaine. It was on these that the police were to focus. It was also felt that the classification of cannabis as a Class B drug suggested that to many users into the belief that the law greatly exaggerated the harmful effects of all illegal drugs. The proposal to reclassify was put to the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, the ACMD, the UK government's panel of drug policy so-called experts. They recommended that reform go ahead, and so it did, despite the grave misgivings expressed by the Daily Mail, probably our most reactionary tabloid newspaper, which reholds drugs, particularly the 1960s, responsible. Well, about a turn on cannabis reclassification was it? Oh, yeah, that's fine. 2 minutes I've got, so I'll rattle through. This consisted of the remarkable about turn cannabis was allegedly prompted by new scientific evidence. This consisted of several research reports which indicated or claimed to indicate that more powerful and persuasive evidence had emerged to demonstrate a causal link between the use of cannabis and mental health problems, in particular onset and aggravation of schizophrenia. In March 2005, the Home Office announced that it would once again submit the question of the proper classification of the ACMD and insisted that it would be irresponsible not to do so in light of the new evidence. The Advisory Council reviewed the research, most of which it had researched several times before. It concluded that there was no proven causal link between cannabis and mental illness, and the association between these phenomena could be explained in either non-causal cultural ways. It was stated that there was little doubt that cannabis use could aggravate already existing mental health problems and call for increased public education and further research. Very sensible. It concluded that while cannabis did pose significant dangers, there was not of the same order of other Class B drugs, such as amphetamines, and the reclassification to Class C should stand. The recommendation was once again accepted by the government, and of course we should infer nothing from the fact that by this time the election had been safely won. Maybe we all have time for some questions and answers shortly, but I would like to make a few points about the cannabis and madness debate in the UK. As we have seen, the assertion of a link between cannabis use and the kind of states of mental confusion which may get labelled as mental is far from being a new one, but is worth examining briefly again. The research which claims to demonstrate a causal link, in fact, does not do so for a simple but profound methodological reason. One cannot isolate human beings from the social and cultural contexts in which their experiences are shaped. One cannot put them in the laboratory and identify the single variable that has caused these unhappy mental states. In reality, our experience and conduct is so subtle and subject to multiple dependencies that the isolation of cannabis use as a factor responsible is impossible. All this research can do at best is to point cautiously to some associations and links that need further investigation. So let's assume for now that some of the studies are correct, that there is a linkage of some sort between madness and cannabis use. What kind of linkage might it be? Perhaps it might be of a similar sort to another empirically derived link, that between cannabis and musicians and artists. While some have suggested a causal explanation here too, it is much more likely that we are dealing with cultural links and relationships. The fact that it is those people who play in rock and reggae bands in our culture are often the same people who are attracted to using cannabis. Smoking pot doesn't mean you'll suddenly turn into Bob Marley or Jimi Hendrix, that you'll suddenly become creative and inspired. Instead of a causal relation, we have a cultural proximity. Artistically creative and inspired people our age have appeared, sometimes more likely to experiment with or indeed make regular use of illicit drugs. The same goes for those who are likely to get into mental trouble. Smoking pot doesn't mean you go mad, rather the tendency to go looking for answers or for inspiration in inner experiences to defy social convention and transgresses their traditional limits. Those are the kind of attributes that lead people towards both drug use and madness. And often enough, incidentally, towards creativity, revelation, self-exploration, I could go on. So again, I would argue that we're dealing here with complex cultural linkages, not causal pharmaceutical ones. But even if we were dealing with the kind of direct cause and effect issue posed by some of those involved in the UK debate, this does not mean that even more stringent legal suppression is the way to go. Dr. Lydia Krabbendam, one of the authors of research carried out by Maastricht University that claimed to identify a doubling of the probability that cannabis use could lead to psychosis, says, "I don't think the effects of cannabis can be used as an argument not to legalize it. It is probably very hard to ban it altogether, and if you legalize it, you can regulate it more effectively. Ultimately, however, the causal argument does not fit with the evidence. Cannabis use has expanded exponentially amongst the UK population since the 1960s, with an estimated 3 million regular users. Indeed, according to our recent European report, some 35% of young people in the UK use cannabis, making us much more like you than our other European cousins. No corresponding expansion of psychotic conditions taking place. If cannabis plays a causal link attributed to it by its vehement critics, the prevalence of schizophrenia could be expected to have grown at a corresponding rate. In fact, as you will all know, the levels of diagnosis have remained stable at around 1 in 100. We should, I think, acknowledge that it seems likely that those who are already experiencing mental problems or in whom such a predilection may be latent could find their difficulties made worse by the use of cannabis. This is more acutely the case in those for whom the development process of maturing are incomplete. Like any drug, cannabis is dangerous if used unwisely. And, like any drug, the informal cultural regulations which develop organically from using it are better controls than repressive measures taken by those who simply disapprove of drug use on moral or philosophical grounds." I'm going to skip over the skunk bit because I guess the time is running out. This issue of the new stronger cannabis, well, it appears that it's true to a degree, but powerful dope certainly existed when I was a youth from Thailand, Hawaii, Kenya, South Africa, Jamaica, even more exotic locations like the Seychelles Islands, not to mention the hash from Nepal, Afghanistan and Lebanon. In fact, anywhere that it grew indigenously, there was good stuff to be found. Some have argued that the skunk, which is the hydroponic stuff grown in the UK, deserves its own slot in the Misuse of Drugs Act schedule, a separate one from that in which ordinary cannabis is placed. But this is highly impractical, suggesting THC content varies widely. One can imagine that it would only be extra money for lawyers. With regard to increased use, what has happened in reality with the increase in use? Well, if anything, the use of cannabis has gone down since reclassification. According to the British Crime Survey, use of cannabis amongst young people in particular has fallen since reclassification, though it has in fact been falling gradually since 1998. The BBC caused something of a stir when it reported in January 2005 that arrests for possession of cannabis had fallen by one-third. Home Office figures demonstrated this was indeed the case, with just 46,000 arrests in the first year after reclassification, a drop of some 36%. This seemed to support the government's claim the decision to reclassify would free up resources that could then be concentrated on Class A drugs. However, the BBC report did not mention the fact that arrests for cannabis had, in truth, been falling for several years prior to the change in the status of cannabis. In 1994, some 81% of all drug arrests were for cannabis possession. The figure steadily dropped over the ensuing years to reach about 55% last year. It seems likely that the decision to reclassify was led by actual police practice on the street rather than driving the same from the top down, as our esteemed leaders would have us believe. So, it seems that cannabis is destined in the UK to remain as a Class C drug for the moment at least. What the overhauling of the entire classification system will bring is at present an unknown. It is underway as we speak. Perhaps we can look forward to a rational, constructed system of grading according to the physiological, psychological, and social harms associated with the various intoxicants we use, alcohol and tobacco included, a system from which the influence of prejudice, tradition, and big business interests have been removed, and in which all judgments of value are made explicit and backed up by reasonable argument. But do I sense a pipe dream? Finally, on the opening morning, we heard a lot about morals and the moral use of drugs. And I would say this: smoking cannabis cannot in any way whatsoever be described as immoral. Arresting and jailing those who smoke it cannot really be described as anything else. Thank you very much.